She has normal
sex. I have a normal sex drive, but I'm a homosexual.
She is a man, so naturally she has normal.
What type of sex drive do you have?
I don't have any.
My need for sex is just second to my need for food, and that need is not fulfilled unless it's with another man, and that's the way it is.
It never occurred to me that he would leave his wife and come live with me. I mean,
and yet we were to be together. How? We didn't know. It was faith. Faith that we would.
I knew it was wrong, but I knew I wanted it, and I didn't care if it was wrong or not.
It's just a matter of accepting yourself, you know. I mean, at times, you know, I hated him, you know. I mean, especially right after the sexual activities. I mean, right then, I hated him.
Because
why? I felt guilty and ugly, you know, dirty, you know.
Well, after I graduated from high school, I didn't have any homosexual experiences for about 2 years or so.
Why was that?
That I can remember. Instead, I just masturbated. That was the supplementary thing. But it was, again, another period of trying to reject my own homosexuality. I just know that when I have sex with a man that I find, it's totally different from my wife, even though I love her.
Surprising, you bet. Shocking, of course. Because nothing in the whole spectrum of American life is so emotionally charged as male homosexuality. Nothing as socially stigmatized, legally entangled, morally mixed up. Surely no drive so basic in mankind, so potently felt and widely exploited in modern life, has ever been so little understood, thus so fraught with fear and venom, passion and prejudice. Its numbers incalculable, its strength unmeasured, its meaning as unexplored as the meaning of sexuality and human freedom itself. But these are its sounds, happy and sad, masculine and feminine, cynical and ingenuous, above all, confused and contradictory. Some are high with humor, others are choked in pathos. All are passionate and concerned, a cross-section of our common humanity. The sounds of people of all ages and colors, all shapes, sizes, and sexual gradations, all beliefs, prejudices, capacities, and but a single common bond. All are homosexually oriented in a society where homoerotic love is taboo. This in spite of findings by the noted Kinsey Institute for Sex Research that two males out of every five that one may meet has at least some overt homosexual experience to the point of orgasm between adolescence and old age. A much higher percentage is attracted and aroused by the same sex. Still, no one knows with any certainty its cause or its cure, or if, indeed, it is even a sickness. Most psychiatrists tend to feel that it is an arrested development resulting from childhood trauma, but they are far from 100% agreement. We only know there are no absolutes, that no child has a total choice in his sexual orientation, and anguished cries of sin, depravity, crime against nature, disease, immorality, or even abnormality are value judgments grounded mostly in habit, herd instinct, and history. The significant thing about homosexuality today is not merely the freer expression with which it is practiced, but the increasing freedom and compassion with which it is examined, discussed, and treated. It is as if at long last we have recognized, however painfully and reluctantly, that we are at the kindergarten level of sexual maturity, that the meaning of our sexuality, whatever shape it takes, begs a bold new perusal as well as a new posture, that sexual behavior is one of the most compelling of human drives, and that responsible sexual freedom may well be a road to psychological freedom and mental health. Thus, it is hardly surprising that, as one wag has put it with some pith, the love that formerly dared not speak its name today will not shut up.
For the human being is neither innately heterosexual nor homosexual, and there is nothing unusual or abnormal about his occasionally engaging in homoerotic acts.
Dr. Albert Ellis, sexologist, and author of an apparently endless number of psychosexual books, claims a high degree of success in redirecting homosexual behavior.
Exclusive homosexuals, however, are disturbed for several reasons. One, they convince themselves that they cannot possibly enjoy heterosexuality without ever really trying to enjoy it. Two, they usually are terribly afraid of rejection by females, of competing with males, of sexual impotency, and of marital responsibility. Three, they do not merely prefer males to females, but are compulsively driven to seek one conquest after another, to have affairs for egoistic instead of sexual reasons, and to magically try to gain masculinity by merging with other males. Four, they become and remain fixed deviants largely because they are highly inadequate, self-condemning, perfectionistic, anxiety-ridden, depressed, dependent, injustice-collecting individuals. The majority, though not all, of these fixed deviants are not merely neurotics, but are actually borderline psychotics. There may be somewhere in this great land a truly happy and mature confirmed homosexual who has chosen his way of life by calm and open-minded preference. If so, I have yet to meet one.
And it is doubtful that he ever will, which is part of science's problem. For there is little reason for the happy or self-accepting homosexual to subject himself to the rigors of possible change through therapy. Obviously, only the emotionally disturbed person is going to pay the high price of professional help. And then, say the experts, only about 1 in 10 of these ever seeks it. When analyst Ernest Vandenhagg was told by a colleague, "All my homosexual patients, you know, are quite sick," Dr. Vandenhagg countered, "Ah, yes, but so are all my heterosexual patients." Most homosexuals and some authorities are unalterably opposed to Dr. Ellis's view that there are these discernible neurotic traits in all so-called fixed deviants. Researchers state there is enough evidence to show that in a fairly sizable number of people, homosexuality is not inherently a form of illness, nor is it accompanied by a form of illness. Most therapists find that the motivation to change is very difficult to maintain. The gay life offers very attractive rewards. The whole pattern of social relationships is different. It takes great self-discipline to give up the gay life, the pleasure and the fun of being with these men who are happy, or at least think they are happy. A middle-aged schoolteacher and brilliant linguist from a small town in Indiana, now residing in Chicago, commented,
"Yes, I'm happy with my sex. I enjoy sex. I like sex life. As I get older, I find that it's just not a central thing to me as it was a younger person. But then I look back rather wistfully and wish that I could go back and do it all again, I suppose."
And all the evidence indicates that, considering the tremendous drive of human sexuality, no law or moral code is going to stop a compulsive homosexual or deviant from seeking his homophile heaven. Even in the face of public prejudice, legal pressures, blackmail threats, religious strictures, and the internal conflicts they induce, this homosexual resigns himself to risk and penalty. Listen to a college-bred youth from Whittier, California, who has been arrested twice for oral copulation in a public place.
"Well, I feel that I am doing what I want to do. I may get arrested 3 or 4 more times before I die. It's just something that I accept. Living a promiscuous life, being in the wrong place at the wrong time, it could happen several times. And I have a savings account, and I have a reserve of money for this. This is the life I'm going to live, and this is the penalty you pay for living this way. This is the way I am, and this is the way I'm going to be. And no amount of fines, imprisonment, jail, disgrace, none of that's going to stop me."
Similarly, a young school teacher who opted for a homosexual relationship with a fellow teacher over what he felt was a hypocritical one with his church.
"The church that he will adhere to. I know of many homophiles who might have sex one night, and, you know, they might go down Main Street or something and have sex with everyone on that street, and then they must make sure that they're to Mass on Sunday the next morning. Well, to me, that's not being true to oneself. so I finally decided it's going to have to be either me or the church. And I decided, well, in this case, it's going to be me. And I've been happy.
Since he has been happy, one might reasonably assume that there must be advantages, however dubious, to life outside the purview of mere sexual pleasure. For sexuality alone never satisfies the gnawing loneliness in any man. As one homosexual poet has written, I have enjoyed every pleasure to satiety. Now I am the victim of free-floating anxiety.
The fact that there will be no children is an advantage, which means that any income we earn does not have to be dissipated in raising a family. We can spend it on each other. Another advantage is the fact that we don't have to worry about some other person discovering that we're queer.
We might admire a beautiful painting or a seascape or a piece of glass or something like this. And not that we're going to get emotional or use words like, how darling this is, or a typical feminine type of language. But we can do this and be ourselves and not worry about what the other one is going to think, if he's going to think that I'm being feminine or something.
The feminine type male, the swish, the Nelly, the queen, long identified as a typical homosexual, in actual fact plays an extremely small part in the half-world of the homophile. But because he is usually an exhibitionist, flaunting female mannerisms, and sometimes makeup and clothes, and adopts his own highly defensive jargon, his presence is more keenly felt. He is a cultural shock to heterosexual society, and a dismay to the vast majority of homosexuals who try to live respectable lives. He is one of the homosexual types who is seen as truly sick by all of the experts, and some feel he is the only homosexual whose sickness could be genetic or glandular in origin. The masks he assumes to allay his fears are usually as hostile as they are pathetic. These are the jumbled sounds of the hair fairies, homosexuals who dress like men but wear women's makeup and hairdos. What they are actually saying is of little consequence.
Oh, in the daytime, she wears her daytime makeup. Oh, wow.
Well, I do. I won't go anywhere without my makeup.
No, during the day,
makeup.
She wears colored eyelashes with different colors,
wow.
Rainbow.
Oh, psychedelic eyelashes. I am.
Boy, we just, we won't pay any attention to anybody. We're walking down the street. Huh? And then about 6 o'clock in the morning, we start looking around, All of a sudden, the ugliest guy starts looking so cute to us. We start shaking it a little more and walk a little slower. Become a little more friendly. And then we end up going home alone. And we go, we kick each other,
The drag queen who dresses like a woman, disports himself like a woman, and often considers himself a woman, views his life.
In my point of view, I'm living a straight life. And what people call a normal life is a queer life to me. I am more or less the feminine part of the whole act. And when I go out with a man, I walk on the inside. The door is always open for me. My cigarettes are always lit for me. When a woman goes out, she should be dressed decently and dressed very nicely. And I won't go out unless I have something nice on.
Do you know what you are?
I guess I'm just a drag queen.
In some shadow world between these extreme types is the homosexual who is confused about his sexual choices. He is still strongly oriented to other males, but he does not quite know what role he is to play. He is usually highly conscious of his sexuality and often displays sadomasochistic tendencies. A young man in San Francisco, where some 30 bars cater exclusively to the gay community, comments,
"Well, I like him big, and I like him masculine, and I enjoy him
overwhelming,
and I like him, I like him hairy, his body hairy, and extremely masculine, and I don't, well, like queens, I could dress up like a boy and go to bed with any queen and play the masculine partner with them. It's different, though, because when they are playing the passive partner, they're feminine, and they're making feminine noises like, oh, and stuff like that. And when a man goes to bed and he is playing the passive partner, which he's never played before, and he doesn't know what to expect. All he does is he feels the pain, and he feels something he's never experienced before in his life, which can be quite an experience.
These homosexual types, whose entire lifestyle revolves around sexuality, are also likely to be highly confused, neurotically compulsive, and in homosexual argot, a cruiser, that is, one who is constantly on the prowl for a contact. To him, all homosexuals are promiscuous.
And this
same deviant puts it this way.
Sex is an every night affair with us, usually, you know.
I mean, not with.
Well, not with all of us, but most of us, it's an every night affair.
Why is it an every night affair?
Well, because homosexuals are usually if you want to call them promiscuous. All it is a game out to satisfy yourself sexually, not mentally.
It's a
mean. And when you try to satisfy yourself mentally, you usually end up getting hurt.
While this man clearly values pleasure for its own sake, what he is really seeking is himself. Immature homosexuals particularly have little awareness of their own individuality and lack self-confidence and self-acceptance. Thus, they live the fragmented existence of the cruiser, gaining, as the late Dr. Blanche Baker put it, quote, a shallow identification with a group and finding a welcome outlet for their resentment and hostilities toward the parent who failed to understand them. Much cruising is a search for the other self, a companion who can understand not just sex, and much of their frenetic lovemaking is a compulsive drive to find their elusive ego ideal, which has generally been damaged by the same sex parent, unquote. The homosexual's rationalization for his promiscuity almost always takes the tack of this Midwesterner.
This nature, the male by nature, I think is promiscuous, whether he's interested in women or men. Society has limited him to a monogamous life, pretty much, but that doesn't say that he's not promiscuous, though. In other words, I think a homosexual can go out and put the make on somebody easier than a man can go out and put the make on somebody beyond, say, a prostitute or something like that. Now, of course, there are many homosexual prostitutes, too.
Hustlers.
The homosexual prostitute is known as a hustler. He solicits incessantly, and his very livelihood depends upon picking up other homophiles.
Some are heterosexual hustlers who specialize with the homosexuals, and some are gay hustlers who specialize. I mean, in other words, they just simply do homosexual acts for money. Whether they're homosexual or heterosexual or a masochist or whatever they are. They could be anything. You would pay somebody to whip you or pay somebody to let you beat them up, I suppose. There are infinite varieties. And of course, I can't say that I've experienced all of them. That would be beyond my poor powers.
It is the hustler who, for all the obvious reasons, is most likely to make contact with the fetishist, who may or may not be a homosexual. A handsome 24-year-old male hustler from San Francisco tells how it's done.
One guy picked me up.
How much did he pay you?
And he gave me $50 to go home with him. And he liked to have somebody take a razor and do light cuts on his belly, on his back. So just... not enough to draw blood, just to make it real red. Little red cuts, and a little blood came out. But, and then he likes cigarette burns, you know, all over his body. And he liked you to tie him down to the bed, spread eagle him, and beat him on the butt. You know, listen there. They want to be a slave to somebody. If you tell them to get down and kiss your feet, they kiss your feet. If you tell them to, anything you tell them to do, they'll do. They're just meek. They wouldn't hurt nobody.
But the majority of homosexuals do not make their contacts with hustlers. If they do not confine themselves to a more or less monogamous arrangement, holding jobs and living a quietly domestic life, they cruise the bars, the private clubs, the beaches and the baths that cater almost exclusively to their furtive fraternity. Very often, the bar or the bath is the scene of a man's initiation into the homophile community. Should the experience also mark a lifetime commitment to homosexuality, it is called coming out. and a wealthy, well-traveled, highly educated homosexual who moved from Ohio to California because of a more tolerant atmosphere remarked,
I was traveling down one of the streets in Los Angeles and passed a steam bath where there was a sign, steam bath and massage. So I went in and for the first time in my life was exposed to a gay Turkish bath. And I was completely frightened. Everything flashed in my mind. Fear of police, fear of venereal disease. But I can't say I was so concerned that I didn't go back again and again and again. And this was my introduction to homosexual life. And I began developing my little black book, which every homosexual carries, listing the favorite spots all over the world. And thus began a new phase of my life.
This same man states the advantages of the bath over the gay bar as a meeting place for sexual activity.
And the reason I enjoy a steam bath is that if it's a gay steam bath and is known to be a gay one, you know that everyone there is homosexual. You've eliminated the guesswork. You know that everyone is there for one purpose. You know that they're clean because they've been steamed and showered. And if you find somebody with whom you wish to have some activity, you can consummate it there in a matter of minutes. And whereas if you meet somebody in a bar, you face all the questions. Is the person a member of the vice squad? Is he actually a hustler? Where do we go? Is he clean? Will I have to ask him to shower first before we go to bed? And all of these problems are eliminated in the steam bath. Not only that, but you see the merchandise. And so it's a very, very satisfactory outlet if it's sex that you're looking for. And that's really all it is. It's basic sex satisfaction. You very seldom ever arrange to meet a person you meet in a steam bath again. It's a one-night stand. It can be very, very satisfying. It can be an excellent release. I have visited perhaps dozens of steam baths at one time or another. I've now built my own.